I'm Maura Dugan. I'm the director of Race Relations 2020 in Columbia, South Carolina, and I'm the senior researcher on a project for the Intractable Conflict Knowledge Base Project, the Conflict Resolution Consortium. The purpose of the project is to uncover creative ways in which people are dealing with intractable conflicts in the United States and to incorporate learnings from this into the conflict resolution field. So, that's my little introduction, Roberto.
And I'm Roberto Chenet. I work out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. I do training and teaching and consulting and intercultural leadership training and conflict resolution. I associate with others to do this work. And I also head up what I call the Southwest Center for Intercultural Leadership. I teach courses periodically at the University of New Mexico and travel around the country, some bit of international work, but work based in New Mexico.
Okay, thank you. Before we get into the substance of your work, if you're working, you know, you're doing some work either as a consultant or, you know, maybe through what you've set up as the Southwest Center for Intercultural Leadership, what sorts of groups or organizations hire you, ask you to do your work?
Let me see. It's pretty varied. Kind of sometimes I draw a blank on this. Let me approach it by just thinking of who I've talked to recently.
Okay.
Let's see. I've been doing some work on an ongoing basis now with the Colorado Mountain College, which is a 7-campus community college that operates out of Glenwood Springs, Colorado, and operates within that, kind of up and down that ski valley.
Uh-huh.
So that type of organization. A local organization here has started a Chicano charter school. They called me recently to do some mediation work among staff and director and so forth. I'm working with a couple of major church groups, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America and the Mennonite Central Committee, both of which have institutionally based Eliminating Racism initiative. So I'm working with them as a trainer and consultant and teacher around racism and conflict resolution and just understanding the whole relationship dynamics of eliminating racism.
Wow.
Recently finished a retreat for people of color who are fighting environmental racism. We used a combination of mindful meditation and facilitated dialogue to look at issues of healing around internalized racism and community building and to promote community building. I work with the Hispanic, in Tempe, the University of Arizona, Hispanic, I forget the whole name of the department. Anyway, I work with them promoting mentorship for people of color in the sciences, but mentoring students who want to get involved in science, some aspect of science, and there's a mentorship program to promote their participation and success in various sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, not long ago, just this morning, consulted with a community activist here in the city, wanting to think about how to implement a strategy to solve a problem within her community. So I don't know, that gives you some idea.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the
pretty wide range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never know, like, who's going to call me, and then I have to think, well, is this something I fit with, or this fit with me kind of thing. So I have to be kind of flexible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. The first question, you know, and I'm just here utilizing the general questions we've set up, and I'll ask you each of them, and as we go through them, we may, you know, add additional, you know, topics or questions to mm-hmm. make it more to fit, so that you can fit talking about your own work better, as best you can, into mm-hmm. the questions. The questions aren't meant to be straitjackets, but I'm going to ask them as they're written. Mm-hmm.
Sure, okay.
So that there's some consistency, you know, in terms of the different responses we get. So the first question has a few parts.
Mm-hmm.
It just tell me about the nature of the social problem or problems on which you work. How do you define it or them? What is your focus within it or them? And what are you or your clients seeking in, from your work?
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, let me take a stab at that. Yeah, sometimes it's kind of broad, so it's kind of, for me, sometimes kind of hard to pin down. I focus it around intercultural leadership and conflict resolution. My interest, I guess, for been a long time is generally what does it take to understand and eliminate oppression in its various forms. As I got into the work, I think I kind of, I don't know if I ended up in it or kind of the situation put me in it. It's often the realm of diversity work, or eliminating racism, sometimes in organizational consultation around effective communication in a diverse setting, that type of thing. I think the social problem is the problem of, again, oppression in various ways, sexism, racism, etc. But it's also the problem that I understand it, as I approach it, that I think we're institutionalized into conflict. So that if you talk about sexism or racism or classism, whatever, the word itself is defining an already institutionalized conflict. So to me, leadership development in a society like ours necessarily requires conflict resolution skills and necessarily requires interdifference or an intercultural perspective. Kind of in my own language, as I go about using my work, I don't even know if it's using different words, and I don't even know if it's a word, but I made it a word. I refer to interdifference sometimes, just it's easy to talk about. So I think another kind of a working assumption I have in terms of the problem is that I think our society doesn't respect differences. The purpose of our society is to reconcile differences through dominance, and I think our society practices what I consider a form of tyranny of conformity. So to me, all of that is creates endless conflict. So there, I don't think there's any way, in my opinion, to do problem solving, to do community building, anything without conflict resolution as an integral part of it.
Great. I probably shouldn't say this on the tape, but I, you know, when I look at the question, I think you've really answered its different component parts. But let me just follow up on a couple of them to get a little bit more delineation. I presume, but I want to check out that that the focus of your activity within, you know, these different problems is as an intervener through training or advice giving. Is that accurate? I mean, that comes from some of the things you've told me about some of your work, but that may not be a very complete definition of your own role.
Yeah, I think sometimes I'm an intervener. You know, somebody's in conflict, they'll call me to help work it out. So, you know, I'm an intervener, I'm a mediator. I've had a lot of experience as a counselor, therapist, so sometimes I'm a counselor. I try to kind of bring all whatever I have to offer to bear on the problem. Sometimes I'm just a teacher, basically around teaching effective communication or community building in an intercultural, interdifference world, kind of teaching people, given that fact, then how do we build relationship and build communities? So sometimes I'm not necessarily intervening, but teaching about that.
Okay. Okay. And do you normally feel that, you know, when you're working with different groups, that they share some of your focus on eliminating oppression?
Yeah, I think generally, yeah. Most of my work, I don't do any marketing for my work. Although, you know, I have some stuff kind of in development to kind of hit different pockets that I'm interested in. But most of my work, not all of my work, is by personal referral. So I do one thing, and that leads to another, that which leads to something else, and so forth. So I find, generally, as a rule, that people who call me know me either directly or through someone else or through something I'm participating in, and they usually know what I'm about. So there's usually some like-mindedness by the time they call me.
Okay.
So I would say, generally, yeah, that we share that. It is very fairly common, though, that they'll call me thinking they want diversity, but as they get into it, they really don't want it because it's too conflicted. So sometimes they think they want what I have to offer. So part of my problem is to assess, one, where they're coming from, or at least to let them know that as they get into this work, they have to think about, do they really want to get into it? So sometimes they think we have more in common than we actually do.
And you would tend then to work for groups who are not only clear about what your focus is, but share those interests.
Right. Yeah. Or sometimes I'll do an education piece. If somebody calls me, I'll do an education piece to see if they want to continue. And then they said, "Yeah, we want to continue."
Okay.
Yeah. So I would say yes to all of that. It's like trying to establish enough commonality so that we can work well together.
Okay. Okay. Now, the next question focuses more on the work itself. And once again, there's a set of questions, and I'll read them all, and as before, you know, you can just try to answer the combination, and then we can pick up other parts to make deepen the conversation a little bit. The question is: tell me about how you do your work. Particularly, what about your work is unique? What unique processes do you use which make your work effective?
Okay, see how I do my work. Well, let's say if someone calls me, I guess my first, in terms of how I do my work, seems like a broad question. If someone calls me or talks to me or whatever, I try and get us find out what it is or what problem is they're trying to deal with, to see if, for one thing, if I fit, and see if I might offer something to whatever they're struggling with. So then I can kind of define how I might approach it, and then tell them what they can expect from me if I get involved with them. So I kind of do that interview process, and sometimes if it's not clear, I'll ask the person who called me to ask another two or three people who are part of the organization that maybe we can all have a lunch or something to kind of get a kind of little broader view. What is it they're wanting to deal with?
Mm-hmm.
So then I can respond to them and then let them know what I do and then see if we can kind of build a little team. What I try and do with an organization or with a group, I go on the assumption that I'm teaming with them. So I say, whatever I do, I want you to know that, you know, we're in this together. Because if there's a problem, this is your problem, and you're asking me to support you and try and help solve it. So that I'm working with you or for you, however we conceptualize it. So you need to know what I'm going to do here. And so we have some kind of agreement on what the outcome may be, or at least what might happen in the process. So I try and establish that kind of a relationship at the outset.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what about my work is unique. I really based on the idea of relationship and community building. I don't know if that's necessarily unique. I think sometimes, especially in the conflict resolution field, too much conflict resolution is attempted, and the relationship community capacity to solve the problem is not deep enough or strong enough. So I always start from the basis of building relationship and human community. And I found, for example, organizations that say want to eliminate racism or eliminate sexism or so forth, commonly don't treat their workers well. So I say, well, you know, if you want to eliminate an oppression, but you don't treat workers well in the workplace, it's not going to work very well. So you might need to look at some other issues. One is workplace issues and effective communication, along with eliminating racism and so forth, because if you try to eliminate an oppression, all you're going to do is remind people how poorly they're treated as workers. Because a lot of this issue goes down to how our society conceptualizes work and treats workers in the workplace. So, you know, so the human community dimension and the relationship dimension to me is fundamental. So I always pay attention to that and bring that into the mix. I also don't attempt to go for the hard stuff, whatever that may be in a problem, without building toward it. Again, on the assumption that human beings and community more effectively, if they're communicating well or having some sense of safety and trust, will tackle the problem more effectively if they have some kind of trust built up. So I guess you might consider what I do. I build toward the problem solving rather than try and attack it directly. If I can control the conditions for that. Sometimes the problem is so immediate, I say, well, let's just sit down and look at it. But nevertheless, even in those situations, I emphasize that if we don't get back to human connection, we're not going to go very far with what we're trying to do. So that piece is always in there. So I think that, you know, that's, and to me, to whatever degree I'm effective is related to the groundwork that I help establish through facilitation, through education, and so forth, around the human connection part of all this. Because sometimes people will want to do diversity work and so forth, and I say, well, let me ask you a question. I say, forget differences for a moment. Just what do you think is the quality of human community in your organization? If they say, well, it's really good, or if they say it's really bad, I mean, people feel are always fragmented and so on and so forth, then I suggest don't try and tackle diversity without also tackling other communication human issues, because you may not be ready to tackle diversity. So, I don't know if that...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe by, without naming anything, but maybe if you can think of a particular appropriate case, But I'm thinking, with your focus on the quality of human community and building human community with the people with whom you're working and the community or organization that they're a part of, can you talk a little bit about how you go about doing that?
I could think of an example. I don't know if this fits what you're asking, but an organization I'm working with for some time has had an eliminating racism initiative. Okay, and that they've had trainers come in and do work around kind of your typical, you know, systemic analysis of racism and bias and white privilege and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so a couple of things have happened, and again, I'm oversimplifying this, but say they start to get backlash. One is people say, well, now everything is always about racism. You know, it, like everything is done through the filter of racism, and then it, like everybody's either racist or what. So they get that kind of a backlash.
Mm-hmm.
People also say that they start bringing in other issues. You know, I think as I mentioned before, people start grievancing around other worker policies and so forth, and different people feeling left out for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And then some people feeling that it's not okay to feel left out, that everything I do is racist. So anyway, things tend to get polarized around that. And then what the organization can do then is that it starts to conclude that the various other complaints that are coming out are an attempt to avoid racism, which is the main thing they're trying to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, yes and no. I said, it's like the other things that are coming out are things that also need to be looked at. So the question is not either or, it's both and. To effectively look at racism, you have to also address other issues that people feel are legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And then bring them back around to looking at racism, because the fact is, you know, of course, white people in particular will find a million reasons to say there's not racism, and I'm not really being racist, and it's not really there, but this other issue is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, yeah, this other issue is there, but it's up to the trainer, it's up to the leadership in the organization to not allow this other issue to become a form of denial.
Mm-hmm.
But it still may be a legitimate issue to look into.
Okay. So in that sort of both and approach,
mm-hmm.
say, picking either one or both of them, what sorts of techniques and processes would you employ?
Well, for example, sometimes it's really common, I think, in organizations where, like, one department doesn't know what the other one really does. Or one cubicle doesn't really know what the other cubicle's doing.
Mm-hmm.
So they make assumptions about each other that may or may not be warranted. So I'll go through a process of helping them define, separate people into departments or into the divisions within their organization. Basically to identify and to validate the work that they do, and then have them educate each other cross-group or cross-difference to make sure that every other department knows what my department does. And then I'll have them say things like, for us to do our job really well, this is what we need from you. Okay, so this is just about effective communication around a shared task.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'll also do some exercises around identifying various work styles. And help people see that there's also diversity of work styles, that there's the visionaries, and then there's the people who just want to get to the work, and the taskmasters and so forth. Okay, to then put all that together and say, look, all of this stuff is operating. Okay, so if we weren't talking about necessarily race or gender or whatever, you have these differences and misunderstandings just within your work environment that are impeding the communication and the sense of community. So I'll take them through a day or two of that type of work.
Mm-hmm.
And then make the connections back to other issues around race and bias and so forth.
Let me just ask you something very specific. When you talk about different work styles,
mm-hmm.
is there any particular model that you tend to use?
Yeah, there's a little exercise. It's called Compass Rose. It divides people into four groups, like where you're going to generalize. You know, there's the people who tend to be the visionaries, the people who tend to be the get-to-the-task people.
Right.
And another couple of categories.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's generalized, but it's also specific enough so that people will fit into
mm-hmm.
generally a category.
Okay.
So,
now,
yeah, so there's that type of thing. There's also, you know, I've been part of it and used it a little bit, but there's an exercise that you're probably aware of. It's called True Colors.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that type of thing, you know. And then there's all that Myers-Briggs kind of stuff. I tend to keep it simple in terms of the Compass Rose things, which is kind of a combination of that.
Okay. Now, if you were working with a community rather than a workplace,
mm-hmm.
How would that vary? I mean, would you still talk about, for example, work styles? Or, you know, how would you approach the project? If there was a community that was trying to deal with eliminating racism, or a church, but something that wasn't primarily a workplace, or where you're, the
mm-hmm.
people with whom you were working,
I would still take a similar approach in that within the say this broader community, there, as I would work with them, I would probably notice differences of approach and so forth. Or assumptions about each other, how people label each other or stereotype each other, that would be relevant. So, you know, again, breaking them into groups or, you know, having a meeting to try and define what the meeting might be about, effective leadership or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so, you know, I just reframe it differently.
Okay. Okay. Let's move to the third question.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had any successes or achievements that you're particularly proud of, and could you tell me about it or them?
I thought about that. I think I have. I think sometimes I have a block about this. I don't know. I do get a lot of feedback from individuals and organizations about. Thank you for your work. You know, we've been able to communicate more effectively since then, or something like that. Or an individual send me a letter, or call me, or tell me how some exercise I did, or something I said, or something had a very profound effect on them. I've had people tell me like, thanks to your work and the way you did it. I met so-and-so at your workshop, and now have a friend for life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm amazed that we could connect so deeply in such a brief time. And I think the way you did it was part of that, so thank you. So that kind of feedback I get.
Mm-hmm.
An organization is now calling us, I say us because another person I'm working with is calling us back, to do another kind of a retreat mediation. It's a multicultural organization, a multicultural staff that we worked with a few years ago, two or three years ago. That was in quite a bit of conflict, and we were able to get them unstuck and to get them moving and working toward implementing their vision. I don't know all the details, and you know, but I know that they've been kind of going along doing it, and apparently now, you know, they need a refresher or things have gotten sticky again.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we were able to get them off their stuck place and get them clear enough to continue their work more effectively,
mm-hmm.
the group of teachers. So I don't know, that it might be kind of vague, but...
I have
a file with various testimonials, but that's, you know,
yes,
you're a great guy and stuff. But I'll be honest with you, I don't know. It's hard to know,
mm-hmm.
Ultimately, what, for me anyway, what difference it makes.
Mm-hmm.
I do have this awareness that it makes a difference. I mean, that makes it, you know, that helps me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me focus in on something in particular, your work with people on internalized racism.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask both the previous question and this one particular to that. You talked about using facilitated dialogue and
meditation.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe that a little bit more specifically? And I'll tell you why I'm asking this, because I've been trying to be as clear as I can with people about, you know, why I'm collecting the information,
mm-hmm.
or why we're collecting the information. In my experience of, you know, reading things about conflict resolution processes and, you know, what people are doing with them and stuff like that, the focus is oftentimes between the individuals or groups, and rather than looking within.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about some things that I consider this somewhat unique, maybe not so much, I don't mean it so much in terms of what's going on around the country necessarily, but in terms of what enters the literature as important for conflict resolvers to think about.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could talk a little bit about how you approach that, what sorts of techniques you use, why you think it's important to deal with something like internalized racism, to, you know, to deal with something within rather than between.
Because the conflict between groups is directly related to the individualized, internalized oppression. So I mean, they're intimately intertwined. So if we're gonna reconcile intergroup conflict, it's like, you know, the whole idea of meditation, you know, peace starts with you. So if you're not at peace inside, if you're not centered, if you're not mindful, that's going to express itself in many ways, you know, and one of the ways it expresses itself, particularly for people who have been victims of racism, is to treat each other badly very often, or all too often. Okay, so that without the personal healing and the personal mindfulness and self-awareness, it's pretty hard to get a handle on that. So that's the idea. So, you know, it's got to be the personal work has to be done. So, you know, and I don't, you know, I practice somewhat. I don't consider myself a person who practices in any broad way. I'm aware of meditation, and I meditate, and I use some of what I've learned in my life, but... So the people I'm working with do so. They practice, they teach meditation, and I think I understand it and practice it enough,
mm-hmm.
to relate to it well.
Mm-hmm.
So my role in the work I'm telling you about, or I had referred to, is in the facilitated part. I think what I'm good at is I have a good understanding. You know, and I always consider myself a learner, but I have a good handle, I think, on internalized oppression, internalized racism, and then how that plays out between people of color. so that as I observe it and try and facilitate discussions where that emerges, I can facilitate it, then I can clarify why are we doing this anyway? What's this about? And then help think about the problem,
mm-hmm.
or the solving the problem eventually. So what I'm finding is that in the past years, the rhetoric around internalized oppression is very common among people of color groups, and they say, "Well, what's going on is internalized oppression." What's not common is the stopping it. And I think that's a major intractable piece right now, is like, how do we stop it? How do we stop tearing each other apart? How do we stop debilitating our organizations because of it? So it's a combination of doing personal work and personal growth, however one does that, however one figures how they need to heal themselves or be healed, and then translating that newfound self-awareness into structuring our organizations more effectively so that we don't dramatize and play out on each other the hurtful effects of racism. So I don't know if I'm getting to your...
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, so it's like the idea of mindfulness meditation is peace starts with you, and what meditation is about is, learning how to go in and... not let your distresses and your pain drive you, but that you learn how to manage it and to be mindful and to be in the process of healing and awareness. And this is just one approach, because I've worked with other approaches, but so that you have a reliable tool, again, whatever a person's tool may be. For somebody else, it may be a therapeutic model or reevaluation counseling, which is my background, but some effective way to deal with the personal emotional pain of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's fundamental. I think that has to be done, in my opinion. And then the growth that hopefully then results from that kind of work then translates into more effective bridging work and conflict resolution work between groups.
Mm-hmm. If you were working with a dominant culture group,
mm-hmm.
so in the United States with a white group,
mm-hmm.
How would incorporating that self-awareness sort of component of it, of your work,
mm-hmm.
And not just you personally, but the team that you set up to work with a given group,
mm-hmm.
what does in your work mindful meditation focus on with a dominant culture mm-hmm. group or team?
Okay, well, let me say, like, in my general work, the meditation work is something specific that I teamed up with others to do.
Uh-huh.
I don't necessarily use it or refer to it in my regular work, although if it's relevant, I'll bring it in. But so let me say, the way I approach it in my regular work, and I do work with a lot of white groups, is just self-knowledge. You see, I think people are racist because they don't know themselves. So what they do is they internalize what society tells them they should be. So, and they don't know themselves well enough. And I think part of the legacy of racism is loss of identity. So you have major groups of people who basically you don't know who they are. And one way that plays out is you see many people who have kind of lost a sense of identity. They gave up who they are to be American. So they tend to be attracted to or sometimes want to pretend to be a person of color. Or they're attracted to those cultures who are still rooted and have a sense of identity. So a couple of things with that. To effectively deal with patterns of racism, you have to know who you are, really. And because racism and bias and so forth is really an imposition. It's not, I don't believe it's not the inherent human being. It also helps to deal with any sense or lack or sense of identity, any cultural rootedness or whatever. It also, which I think is fairly common in, among privileged people, is that they feel it's their world, so that they want to know who you are, but they don't have to tell you who they are.
Yeah.
So to whatever degree, they can find out who they are, and they can learn to share what that's about, and particularly identify their particular oppressions, because everybody's been oppressed. Okay, and the bridging work around oppression and around diversity requires that people know how they've been oppressed, and I'm not here talking about in kind of a pathological sense, you know, although that does happen, but it's like every human being, unfortunately, has been oppressed because our society doesn't know how to validate uniqueness. It tries to stamp it out. So as people get in touch with how their humanity has been invalidated, that self-knowledge, particularly as they get healed from it, enables them to empathize with people who are different.
Okay.
So I don't know. I could kind of stick with it, but does that
question? That's helpful.
So it's like kind of a typical and kind of stereotyping, and for the discussion, kind of a white group will come and say, "Well, tell us how to fix it, or tell us what diversity is all about." I say, "Well, how about examining your own diversity? You know, what are the differences among you? Because there always are. You know, there's class, gender, sexual preference, etc., etc." But they're not willing to look at that because diversity has been stereotyped as related to people of color, which is their problem anyway, not ours.
Right.
So you have to help a white group kind of get to know itself individually and as a group,
mm-hmm.
if they stand any chance at all of understanding the diversity issue. Mm-hmm. You know, because they'll often say, well, you know, I have an all-white students in my class. How can I teach them about diversity? Well, what are the differences within? You know, and help them figure out different ways to elicit the differences within the room, which often are obscured because people are reluctant to do the self-aware part.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's, have you noticed any specific difference it's made in people's work to have gone through that exploration?
Yeah, it can be quite transformative for many people. You know, they start living in a different world. They kind of break out of the isolation of their particular privilege or culture. You know, and they begin to see all the differences out there, and they begin to understand. One of the pieces I like to teach is, I refer to it as, you need liberating yourself from your assigned role. That the way the institutionalized oppression works in our society, you know, it's like we're kind of born into polarization, you know, if you're on the white side or the people of color side or whatever. So that's an assigned role. You don't have to act that way, you know, if you define what racism, white racism is about. You don't have to act like that. It's your choice.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to have those biases. So then you have to decide if you want to liberate yourself from that and not be like that. And I find people who go through that liberation or start to get on that road start acting very differently, and they start advocating and speaking out on things they never thought about before. And kind of their eyes are open to become learners of what's really going on around them,
mm-hmm.
you know? And they begin to ask questions, like say a workplace, for example. They begin, all of a sudden they become aware of how this particular policy is actually exclusionary, and how this particular policy that they've been working to implement all this time is actually oppressive.
Mm.
So I say, hey, you know what, I realize listening to you that the way we've been doing it is really hurtful to people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'll be doing a thing, you know, and then somebody will say something like that. You know, I just really been listening to you, and the exercise was helpful and so forth, and I just realize we've been doing it all wrong.
Right.
So that kind of thing happens.
Thank you. That's very good. I mean, that's a very helpful contribution to this because, as I say, for example, when I've previously talked about education's role in resolving conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I will talk about, you know, understanding an issue, understanding who your allies might be, understanding that there are techniques that can be used that may be helpful, all of this stuff. But I've tended in the past to leave out understanding myself.
Right, yeah.
And so I think you're really talking about a whole dimension that isn't really paid attention to in the literature.
Well, yeah, and also it's like, what I learned, you know, like, there's always this kind of a, have you ever been in this cultural sharing things? You know, I'll tell you about my culture thing, approach to diversity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I learned a long time ago that it's by and large a waste of time, you know, not like, you know, in a way, you know, I don't want to, I mean, it's a bad thing to exchange recipes, what the heck, you know? What the hell, we all got to eat, but that's not diversity, okay? That's basically using food to cover your fears, what it is. It's still a good thing, but I realize that because of the dominant ideology, if somebody's in that mindset, you could share your culture with them all you please and dance and sing and bust your butt, and they interpret everything through their privilege. So then they leave the room feeling culturally enriched, but they don't understand a whit about oppression. So culture sharing, you know, is doesn't do it. So without transforming the heart and mindset of the listener, they have to understand their role in the conflict you're trying to eliminate. If they don't understand that, there's not going to be any headway. They can't see it as out there. They have to see it as in them already in order to get to that transformative part. So I don't assume anything. I always approach it in terms of self-awareness to begin with.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the fourth question.
Uh-huh.
Have you had any failures which caused you to change something about the way you do your work?
Yeah, let me try and think about it. I try to avoid them if I can.
Oh, sure.
I try to avoid thinking about
yeah, so do I.
Yeah, I love all my failures. I keep a big giant list. No, let's see. I just found out about kind of a form of a failure the other day. I worked with this group in Taos three times, a small social service agency. Then I ran into one of the Chicanas who worked there who had quit. And I don't know, you know, there's so much dimension, and actually, there's a way, even, like, I will say that the work that I do, a lot of it is like, I think it makes a difference, but in the broad scheme of things, it's a drop in the bucket. You know, because agencies don't have the time or the money, and I don't have the time either, like, to do the real, what a group really needs, which is a long, extended work, you know?
Right.
So, but, you know, you do the best you can. But then I found out that, you know, some of the things I had worked hard to help them understand and practice, it was hard to tell just from this feedback, but it didn't seem to have made that much difference. People still, the woman, New Mexico suffers from what I call bureaucratic colonization. It always, not all our agencies, but many, most it seems to be, they hire white people who are culturally incompetent, and they set up the conflict that way. It's a form of, again, what I call bureaucratic colonization. So I try and work with that and teach them, and it looks like they're getting it. Then I hear later that they did such and such that showed me they didn't get it at all. Mm. So the people of color started quitting or rebelling or whatever. So it sounded like my work didn't help much in this particular agency.
Mm-hmm.
So then I started thinking about it. Well, you know, I think I need to improve how I assess what they really want to do. And so I've learned, because that experience is not uncommon. So sometimes I'm pretty naive myself.
Mm-hmm.
I try not to be, but I assume goodwill and so forth, so I launch into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I discover afterwards that I was too naive and I didn't ask some hard questions early on
mm-hmm.
that I should have asked,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I need to get sharper here. So I thought, well, next time I do that, I need to be sharper in terms of the questions I ask and so on and so forth. Sometimes I get feedback where it's clear to me that people misunderstood. They took the fun part of what I was doing, because I try and keep a balance, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they remember the fun part, and they don't remember the hard part.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, I think I need to, maybe I myself, because I continually examine my own fear of conflict. So my struggle has been to not let my fear of conflict influence or water down the message that needs to be out there. Because sometimes I'm tired, sometimes I don't want to deal with their stuff. I say, well, I'm not going to do that, or I'm not going to say that, because that'll trigger their discomfort level immediately, and I'm too tired today. I've done that. I think that's a failure in terms of what needs to happen to make people accountable.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, so in the broad scheme of things, I said, well, my own personal ethic is that after all is said and done, no matter how tired I am, I'm not going to hedge on some basic truths about oppression. Because after all is said and done, I measure it in terms I have to live with myself. So I'll always say it and put it out there. But I think sometimes I've done that more effectively than others.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm continually assessing myself, particularly sometimes when I hear about what happened afterwards through whatever grapevine I hear it. I think to myself, well, maybe if I'd have been tougher, might have made a difference. An ongoing struggle for me around kind of looking at successes or failures, particularly with white people, if you get hit them with too much reality on this issue, they're not emotionally mature enough, many of them, to handle it. So they end up blaming you for their feelings. If you hit them too hard, they shut down. If you don't hit them hard enough, they stay in denial. So walking that fine line sometimes is a real challenge.
Yeah.
Of course, you have, different models out there. I think I've tried to walk a middle ground, kind of a somewhat accountable but gentle approach, kind of like a healing warrior approach. And I don't know. I don't know if I finally reconcile it by saying that's just my style.
Right.
I used to feel guilty that I wasn't tougher. I said, well, there's plenty of people who are, so I'll let them do that. Meanwhile, I'll do what I do.
Right.
Because I can't be that way anyway, at least not in a sustained way. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So, I don't know if I'm still talking about failure. So, sometimes I get feedback from somebody that's just like totally wiped out or calls me and screams at me or something like that. So, I asked the question after I calmed down, what is the truth in the feedback that I'm getting? And what is it saying about my approach?
Mm-hmm.
And so then I try to take it seriously and see what part I am, in fact, responsible for. And sometimes I think I get overly self-critical. That's part of my internalized depression.
Right.
But I think it's paid off in the sense that I think I've taken my failure seriously and sincerely have tried to transform it into learning. And I think some of what I'm effective at is actually the result of my failure.
Well, and that's what the question is really trying to get at. Because oftentimes, I'll share something with you. When I was in, when I lived in D.C., I was involved with the local chapter of what was then called Spider, and we put on this very interesting day-long mini-conference where we were trying to explore the similarities and differences in different sort of spheres of the field in terms of how labor management or marriage mediators or, you know, or divorce mediators, whatever, how different spheres dealt with conflict and what were the similarities and the dissimilarities. And we decided to ask these key people from these different spheres to share with the group an example of a failure and what they had learned from it. Well, there were five people there. And four of them mumbled something or other. And then the final person who was, you know, who was in, actually had the most prestigious position of the five, told this story that was just, I mean, it was just a whopper. I mean, it was terrible.
You mean their account of their failure?
Not their account of their failure, but the failure itself was a very... Well, it wasn't a little thing. And what his telling that, and then he talked about what he had learned from it, what he had done differently, and what he had done to address the harm that had been done by the failure. Well, one of the things that happened was that opened the whole, you know, that was right at the beginning of the day. I mean, he had publicly, as the most prestigious person there, shared this huge failure.
Kind of set the tone for the day.
Right. Well, it freed up everybody.
Yeah.
Because nobody could top him anyway. And
right.
What it did was that it allowed people to not only have learned from their experience, but be able to share it in a way, you know, if I only share the learning, and I don't share the process that got me to it, that's very academic to the person that I'm talking to. Whereas if I take them on my journey, well, you know, they're more likely to it. So that's the only reason for asking about failures is the learning.
Well, I think it's a critical question. I think, and it's I think it's really more fundamental than the successes, because it gets at the heart of fear of failure or fear of conflict. And I think, so what I've learned about diversity, so-called diversity work and conflict resolution, it's always about learning. And if you don't know that, then you're going to hook, and you're going to try, if you try to always be successful versus what am I going to learn from this, there's a whole different mindset that gets communicated. Let's give you an example, okay, kind of in mainstream mediation, so they don't teach... In my opinion, they don't teach the essence of the conflict between races, and they don't teach, you know, I'm generalizing because I know, you know, a lot of programs do, but it's like, what's the nature of the conflict? And part of the training should include kind of a self-awareness about my experience with conflict and failure. What are my fears? Why am I, why am I afraid of conflict? I think that's a fundamental piece for anybody who would attempt to do conflict resolution.
Right.
Because it basically taps into the dynamic of the relationship, you know, and it gets off this pretense that everything's always going to be a success. Because I think what happens is the fear, I've seen this happen quite a bit, if the fear will cause a mediator, for example, or a trainer to structure things as a way to protect themselves. And the participants intuitively get it, that it's about you, it's not about me. Because they know that the mediator or the facilitator is protecting themselves, not really interested in them. Which then can result in major conflict, of course. You know? Because I've mediated that type of situation where they had literally a rebellion. And what I learned from that in a very dramatic way was that the rebellion was engendered by those who were trying to teach conflict resolution.
Wow.
Because their fear caused them to control the agenda and to suppress the potential conflict from the participants, all in the name of teaching conflict resolution. It was a beautiful experience because I kind of saw how it crashed and burned, and luckily at that time, you know how nice it is when something crashes and burns and you're not, it's not because of you. But you come in as a healer and as an intervener and as a learner, you know. So we had some just incredible debriefing about what happened here and why did it happen, you know.
Uh-huh.
Just really good.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Is there any written information about, you know, either that you've written up or that that somebody else has written up about your own work or some of the things that you work on that that you think it would be good for me to read, to include in my analysis of the findings that, you know, of, you know, just trying to not so much analyze them, but...
Right, I probably have some stuff. Me and writing don't get along very well, unfortunately, but I keep struggling to write stuff. I have some stuff that may be relevant to your question, and in fact, I have to review some things because I'm preparing to go do some training. I could keep that in mind and maybe put together a packet or something.
That'd be great. And you can either, if it's on your computer, you can just email me something and say, I'd like you to read this, or you know, you could, if it's not in that form, you can mail me anything you want.
In fact, I put together, in fact, I may use it because I'm going to go work with some educators in Michigan. I developed a concept that I call reciprocal outreach, which when I first thought of it, because I was working with an organization that was trying to get white people more accountable, and they were just too scared. I said, well, let's call it reciprocal outreach. Because what reciprocal outreach is you don't, it emphasizes mutuality, is that who do you want to include? And reciprocal outreach is that you join them even as they ask you to, you ask them to join you. Okay, so it brings in the self-awareness piece in the concept. And I wrote that up kind of as a three-hour mini-training. What that's about, I could maybe get that to you at some point.
That'd be great.
You know?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Because I wrote it up in the way that somebody, say in a three-hour workshop, could take people through some exercises to help them understand, at least begin to understand, the practice of reciprocal outreach.
All right.
And again, it's just like inventing a term. You know, sometimes I don't know as well. It's just like more hype. You know, it's all the world needs. We don't have enough hype in the world. But on the other hand...
But I do like the sound of it. And that may be because...
It sounds good, no?
Yeah, it does. I like it.
It's got to be... It must be something to it if it sounds so good. So, but
well,
anyway.
It also seems to me it gets at something that you said before.
And mutual respect.
Right.
Beyond it. Okay.
Right.
It has no idea what that is.
Right.
They understand respect with each other. But they don't understand, the system doesn't understand mutuality across differences.
Mm-hmm.
And why should it? It doesn't have to, because we're joining it. And the reason so many of these problems are intractable is because when people of color join the white system, we lose our community, and the white system does not have the ability to engender community. It's too mired in individualism. So we're losing community at an incredible rate, the sense, you know what I mean, the sense of what that is.
Right.
So the whole assimilation model where some people join a dominant group is a total dysfunction.
Yeah.
It's a total dysfunction. It'll never work, ultimately. It's not working. So how do we reframe that? And the whole idea of reciprocation is that. We need to totally think differently.
Right.
And so, you know, I'll say to groups, you know, everything you've thought about diversity so far, forget it. It's not really diversity anyway. It's just a different, it's just a form of accommodation to dominance anyway.
Right. And it occurs to me that that also has a dimension that, you know, that strikes me as, you know, living in a community that's about 70% African American, and being a community leader within that community, one of the questions I constantly ask myself is, how do I contribute to this community in a way that's respectful of the majority in the community?
Yeah.
And, you know, because I'm not, I don't want to try to break down the ethnic community that's there,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
not being a member of that ethnicity,
mm-hmm.
you know, how do I contribute to it? And the concept of reciprocity offers a different handle for exploring that question, I think.
Yeah. And that's what I finally concluded, that it's helpful.
Well, I think it's helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it is helpful for many people, and that's exactly the issue, you know. It's like we all need to, I consider oppression, it's like we've been socialized into relating to each other in an oppressive way. And we totally need to reframe and recreate intercultural
mm-hmm.
or interdifference relationships.
Yeah.
That to me, that's beginning to get at the heart of diversity.
Well, and also your whole concept of interdifference, which you mentioned at the outset,
mm-hmm.
Provides a way of getting at why you're doing the sorts of things that you talked about doing earlier with a dominant group, of getting them to explore their differences.
Yeah.
So that that's a broader term to use,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that if we're talking about diversity and it's already been defined out there as, you know, I mean, I may be aware that I add some diversity to my community, but most people don't look at it that way.
Right.
You know, the community is diverse because it's largely black.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's not diverse. Well, I mean, it may be diverse in terms of different.
Yeah.
So the notion of interdifference allows for getting at some of those mm-hmm. things, that the way that diversity is popularly understood is not.
No. And then, in fact, I always enjoy with a group, like especially like a predominantly white group, with some of the exercises I do, when that help them understand that our society doesn't give a damn about any difference.
Right.
Within any group.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get this aha experience. Yeah, you're right. You know, it's like just within our own group, people are either too big or too small, and they wear glasses or they have a physical difference.
Right.
There is not one person in the room who has not been invalidated because of a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So you think we live in a society that knows how to validate difference?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's story is the same. It's how they overcame their exclusion.
Hmm.
So what are we celebrating here without reframing how our society relates fundamentally to differences?
Mm-hmm.
So which means that the whole rhetoric around diversity is just that. It's rhetoric.
Right.
Which obscures how we actually really relate to differences.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, where are we at? Are we about...
We are about done. I just want to... I want to pose this question again, although it relates to our previous conversation, and you might not have anything to add to it here.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other groups you feel are doing important, effective, and innovative work on the same issues that you are working on? Would like to put them on a list, follow up on this project. And if you think of any, then there's the question of contact name and information, and whether your name can be used as a reference.
I think some time back, actually, when we spoke about, NCBI, Sherry Brown, the work that they're doing. And I mean, a lot of people I'm working with who do similar kind of work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Many of us who do this type of approach came out of reevaluation counseling as an entity that helped clarify for us the emotional part of oppression and the healing of it and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So any group that's has had contact or has kind of evolved from that model, I think there's a lot of groups doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the work we did using mindfulness meditation in a beautiful isolated mountain setting is a very, very incredible tool that should be used and nourished and so forth. And more of that kind of work, I think, needs to happen, specifically designed retreats in whatever model, in whatever place, to heal from the effects of oppression in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So any group that's doing something like that, you know.
Okay.
I know there's many, many groups out there, which I'm sure you know. You know better than I in terms of the contacts that you had.
Well, that's fine. You can always suggest anything mm-hmm. later on that you want to. Is it okay to use your name with Sherry Brown, or would that be meaningful? I don't think Joan's gotten a hold of her yet.
Oh no.
No, I don't think so. At least when I talked to Joan at the end of last week, she hadn't.
Sure. I mean, you know, we know each other. You know, if you want to say that in terms of what you're doing, you know, I really think that her work and others that she's worked with are just need to be included in any kind of innovative and effective method to deal with these issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know.
Well, I've kept you on the phone longer than I said I would, but this has been just a very rich conversation for me, and I really appreciate your time, and I feel I've learned a lot this morning, and I will share with you how I'm writing up what I'm writing up, so if I've misinterpreted something you've said, or if I've missed something that was more important, or you just have something to add to it, that can still happen.
Okay, while I'm thinking, let me just share kind of a final couple of thoughts here that mulling as we've been talking. One is, if you look at, kind of take our conversation in the context of the overall field of conflict resolution, kind of looking at what's, you know, problems that are intractable, I think we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's about what I've learned from, learning is sometimes if you highlight specific aspects of a reality and draw attention to them, people look at them differently. So having said that, say within the context of conflict resolution, I think more attention needs to be paid to certain things. One is there needs to be much more focus and nourishment and training and teaching about internalized oppression and how to resolve that conflict.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be just like a part of something. It needs to be the something that people start developing expertise about.
Okay, yeah.
You know, because I think it needs to be, the whole concept and practice of it, of healing, it needs to be elevated like to a major peacemaking tool. Another aspect that I think needs to be looked at more specifically is the tendency to fear conflict in our backyard to then promote world conflict peacemaking. I think it's scarier sometimes to look at our own backyard because people don't know what the hell to do with that. So that needs to be, mm-hmm. we need to not let the global peacemaking become an excuse, which I think often it is, all too often, for denying our own, you know, well, we as a country practice that, obviously, but
uh-huh.
Certainly conflict resolvers need to not practice that. another aspect of this would be, in my experience in the world, there is no time for teaching conflict resolution that's not intercultural.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if we keep training mediators and so forth in the mainstream model of mediation so that the result is you don't have interculturally competent conflict resolvers.
Right.
I think we're kind of wasting our time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be that sound judgmental, but it's like what I find is people who can do intercultural mediation can do mediation.
Right.
Right. Huh? But it doesn't go the other direction.
That's right.
So we have, it's a dysfunction
in
terms of peacemaking. You know what I mean?
Yes. I share that point of view partially because I discovered early on that if there's difference involved in a conflict along lines that socially, societally impact how people do things and how people perceive themselves and others.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's gender, could be age, it could be, it obviously could be race or ethnicity, but even if the onset of the conflict, the precipitator of the conflict, has nothing to do with the difference,
mm-hmm.
the way in which the conflict unfolds will become increasingly impacted by those differences.
Right, yeah.
And so if your point, you know, you needn't have a conflict about a racial difference or a cultural difference or whatever to need, you know, some understanding of intercultural mediation in order to be able to deal with it, because as soon as those, as soon as the thing starts to unfold, whatever the differences are going to impact it.
Uh-huh, right.
That's my, so that I, you know, that's why I would say what you've just said is so increasingly important, because, you know, so I don't know if that's helpful to you, but it's just my little bit of wisdom at the end.
Right, no, it's great. I wish we had just time to, which maybe we all need some time to just, you know, take these questions basically and have an extended dialogue with many people about this stuff.
Right.
So,
well, and this is meant to be a start of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I'm hoping that if we can, if Joan and I can write up some things that we can excite people by,
mm-hmm.
that will help to promote more in-depth looking at the sorts of issues that are being raised.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Well, good.
Yes.
Just occurred to me finally, too, I don't know if you've, in all of this, you've talked with Beth Roy and S.Y.
I know that Joan has been trying to talk with S.Y. for something over 2 months.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's happened yet. Doesn't happen within the next few days, it's not going to be included, which is really a pity.
Because both of those people, along with many others, you know, with the NCPCR, and all kind of, we all got a PhD, so to speak, in learning from all about all this stuff, you know. So there are other people, I think, that are a wealth of insight. So anyway, good talking to you.
Well, thank you very much,
yeah.
And I'll look forward to our next opportunity to
okay.
have a conversation. But thank you so much for all this time.
All right.
Thank you, Roberto.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.